Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
Hello, hello, hello. Today is the 12th of April, 2022, good gracious, the glorious future year of 2022. And as a result, I'm going to be reading for you today selections from a, pardon me, selections from a little book called Spacecraft Designer, credited to one A. Romanov, which was published in Moscow by the Novosti Press Agency in 1976. Subtitle is The Story of Sergei Korolev. It says, editing completed on February 13th, 1976, if you want to be hyper-specific about things. And why? Well, April 12th, we have to remember. April 12th, 1961 was the date of the first human space flight. Yuri Gagarin launched into orbit of the Earth. And by pure coincidence, and I know this because I've spoken to the people involved, by pure coincidence, April 12th, 1981 was the first flight of the American Space Shuttle. And so many of us in the space community like to celebrate this date. There's a worldwide celebration known as Yuri's Night, where people basically just have a party on the evening of the 12th of April. And even Tumblr seems to be getting into the act. I saw a banner on the site saying, it's Space Day! So they've got some enthusiasts, although they may not be very well connected to the wider enthusiast community. So, I'm going to read, as I said, some selections from this lovely little book. You know, Korolev's very name was a secret, was a state secret for a while. Because, you know, people in the USSR, of course, always afraid. Well, anyway. So, inside the flyleaf, it says, dedicated to all who strive to probe the universe for the benefit of mankind. To the memory of those pioneers of extraterrestrial expanse, academician Sergei Korolev and cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin, to the memory of all those who devoted their life to the great goal of space exploration for the sake of the planet Earth. Author. I ought to say that there are ambiguities. Some people translating the academician's name, say Korolev, others say Korolyov. Partly this is ambiguity of how exactly you should transliterate things from Russian or Cyrillic into Latin or English phonetic specifically, but also due to the fact that the academician was born in 1906 in Ukraine, so he sort of has a Ukrainian, perhaps, form to his name as well as a Russian one. Anyway. I have no doubt that the time is near, this is facing the title page, I have no doubt that the time is near when powerful spaceships weighing many, many tons, equipped with various scientific instruments and manned by large crews, will leave the Earth and, like the legendary Argonauts, set out on a long journey. It is to be hoped that scientists of different countries will cooperate more and more in that immense and noble endeavor for the benefit of mankind as a whole, for the sake of peace and progress. And then from academician Mstislav, and so that was from Korolev himself, and then from academician Mstislav Kildish, the name of Sergei Korolev will forever be associated with one of the greatest achievements of science and technology of all times, the dawn of the age of space exploration by man. He was a leading designer of rocket and space systems, which ensured success in the initial stages of investigation of outer space. These included the first artificial Earth satellite, Sputnik, the first moon shot, and the first spacecraft to circle the moon and photograph the reverse side, the first manned space flight, and the first walk in space. Korolev's devotion to his work, unusual gifts as a scientist and designer, his bubbling energy and outstanding organizational abilities played a major role in resolving the complex scientific and technical problems that stood in the path of development of the rocket and space technology. He possessed enormous talent and boldness of scientific and engineering vision, and this contributed to the realization of the most complicated scientific and technological projects. Many of academician Korolev's ideas were widely applied and extended in rocket and space engineering. He trained many scientists and engineers who are working today in various scientific and design organizations. Sergei Korolev devoted his whole life to selfless service to his homeland, to the development of an advanced science and technology. His outstanding talent, unflagging energy, and passionate soul evoked the deep respect of all those who knew and worked with him. Academician Sergei Korolev belongs to that number of wonderful Soviet scientists whose contribution to the development of world science, to the progress of civilization, is ineradicable. Forward. On all sides, the concrete islet is lapped by waves of sands of the desert, silent, monotonous, and endless. A searing sun, a transparent, cloudless sky. Heat. At the edge of the island stands a gigantic multi-stage launch vehicle. It is crowned by a silvery spaceship. The concrete islet is the launching pad of the Soviet cosmodrome, Baikonur. In the daytime, the sight resembles a big saucer covered by a limpid blue bowl over which, leaving not a trace, the flaming disk of the sun slowly rolls in an arc. At times, it is so fiery it seems it must melt the steel masts of the high-voltage lines disappearing over the horizon, and turn the towns and villages in its path, the flocks of sheep, the people tormented by the heat, into ashes. At night, the same saucer, only smaller, and covered by a black bowl sprinkled with myriads of twinkling stars, far and near, bright and dim, and the more one stares at them, the more clearly are they distinguished. Altogether, the earth on which one stands, the stars that are all around, and people, and everything created by them, seems one whole, a living organism, powerful and marvelously fair and harmonic. No matter how often I come here, I always experience a feeling of pride and admiration. This feeling arises because Baikonur is the place from which the Earth's first artificial satellite was launched in 1957, which marked the beginning of space exploration. And then on April 12, 1961, the legendary Vostok, with Yuri Gagarin on board, began its ascent into space from here, a feat which stunned the world. Thus, the morning of the space age dawned over the world. Here, in 1961, on the concrete launching pad of Baikonur, at the foot of a giant rocket, I first met academician Sergei Korolev, the chief designer. Further meetings and conversations with the scientists took place in the design office where rockets and spaceships were born, in the USSR Academy of Sciences, which formulated the ideas of modern cosmonautics, at celebrations in the Kremlin held in honor of the first daring feats of Soviet scientists and cosmonauts. The notes I made of these conversations, many of which Sergei Korolev not only had a chance to read, but even to edit, and his articles published in newspapers and magazines, serve as the documentary foundation of my book and are presented under the heading Sergei Korolev Speaks. The reader has an opportunity to learn the story of the life of this man and to and struggle for his ideas in his own words, to look through his eyes at the tomorrow of cosmonautics, which year by year enters the life of man more deeply, as space itself becomes a sphere of man's activities. So I'm going to begin with the section called On the Road to the Planets. Now, there's some very good material in the immediately preceding section, but this is the one I definitely want to get all the way through, and then I can go back and read some of the other stuff if desired, as time permits. So the section On the Road to the Planets is divided into subsections. April 1961, Those Hours at Baikonur, Only the Cosmonaut is Calm, 1 minute to countdown. Space feet. 90 legendary minutes. His name is Yuri Gagarin. Word Road to Tomorrow and The World Applauds. I will note, by the way, that the same rocket which carried that first satellite into space in 1957, the same rocket which carried Gagarin into space in 1961, is the rocket which continues to carry all Russian manned space flights. They keep trying to replace it, but so far has not happened. So Korolev's legacy lives on in a very concrete way. Okay. The beginning of the chapter. Sergei Korolev speaks. Today, Gagarin's flight is history, but it is impossible to forget those days and nights. They were difficult and tense for all those living and working at the Cosmodrome. They realized that the impending event was unprecedented, audacious. After all, for hundreds of years, outstanding minds have dreamed of man entering space, of solving the riddles of the universe, of settling it. They dreamed! But Soviet people became the participants and witnesses of that great day, when one of the most wonderful fairy tales of mankind became reality. Man's flight into outer space, a flight into the unknown. Everyone comprehended that there was an element of risk involved, but the first flight aboard a heavier-than-air machine was also fraught with risk. I am confident that genuine science cannot advance without accepting a reasonable degree of risk, without venturing. That is dialectics. What other thoughts and feelings we had, above all, the feeling of responsibility, special and wholehearted. It's one thing to launch a rocket, a machine, all kinds of things have occurred. And quite another, the incomparable flight of a man, Gagarin, a pilot whom all of us had grown to love. For many of us, including me, he could have been a son. No, none of it was simple. Yuri comprehended what it meant to be the first to go up into space. How could he forget that back on Earth remained his mother, father, wife, daughter, brothers, sisters? But he considered it an honor to take place in the space flight. A sense of great responsibility to his motherland. That was a remarkable quality of that valorous son of the planet Earth. There was another feeling that gripped us, a feeling of confidence, inexplicable, intuitive. It helped all of us. In those days, a marvelous serenity reigned over the Cosmodrome, a sense of inspiration, uplift, and expectation of something big, perhaps not fully acknowledged, but such that people did not spare themselves. Everyone did their utmost, even beyond that. Gagarin's flight lasted 90 minutes? Yes, 90, but mankind marched toward it for centuries, and we, Soviet scientists, for about 40 years. The point is that each minute of that 90 minutes cost a great deal. I think that day we first understood how long a minute is, and how endless an ordinary earthly hour. I know people who in the course of that 90 minutes acquired more gray hairs at their temples and their lives probably shortened by more than 1 year. These people resembled Gagarin. They too were walking along untrodden paths, were discoverers in their field. One can understand their anxiety. Can you name a specific year when we acquired complete confidence in the success of the undertaking? In October 1960, I had full right to say that at that time the necessary conditions and means existed that made it possible for a Soviet explorer to carry out a space flight, but I believed that we had to acquire practical experience in launching orbital spaceships and bringing them back to Earth safely. We had to thoroughly work out, in the course of numerous space flights, the whole complicated technique of the business. We believed that the accomplishment of a manned space flight would open new, unprecedented perspectives in the development of science. I will never forget the true words spoken by academician Alexander Nesmeyanov a few days after the successful flight of Yuri Gagarin. They were impossible to forget. Civilization has a long, wonderful history. Each of its deeds, be it the creation of the first written symbols, or the invention of the first steam engine, or the first circumnavigation of the globe, mark milestones when mankind rose one step higher, affirming the power of progress and creative work. These feats were not always perceived at once. A harsh struggle took place between the old and the new, and the more revolutionary the event opening the road to the future, the sharper the resistance by the past. Only one thing can be added to these words. That is the way it always has been, and that is the way it always will be. Details, facts, recollections. In the first week of April 1961, Korolev arrived at Baikonur Cosmodrome together with his closest associates in order to supervise the technical preparations for the space flight. He devoted all his energy and knowledge to this job, on which depended the next, perhaps the most important day in his life. The assembly and testing shop is a huge building, the ceiling some 20 meters high. Here, the launch vehicle and spaceship were assembled and then tested. Korolev's deputy, Leonid Voskresensky, was in charge of the shop. The authors of all the systems of the launch vehicle and spaceship were present. Sergei Korolev and Konstantin Rudinov, chairman of the State Commission, entered the shop at the moment when powerful cranes had carefully deposited the second stage of the rocket, and resembling a gigantic spindle with an engine, on the assembly support. Then another four blocks of the first stage were added. Altogether, they formed a kind of bunch. 20 nozzles of the rocket engines gleamed dully with a reddish tinge. Voskresensky was the first to notice the new arrivals. He came forward. "May I report?" "Yes, please," Rudnev replied. "The assembly of the launch vehicle is nearing completion. In a few minutes, we will begin installing the spaceship." Korolev did not wait till he finished, but walked over to the rocket. He mounted a metal ladder and disappeared behind the structure. Leonid Voskresensky continued his report. "We are strictly on schedule. The complex will be on the launching pad at the time set by the State Commission." "Thank you." Looking him in the eye, the chairman asked mildly, "Worried?" "I am," the engineer confessed. Rudnev and Voskresensky went off to the control room of the assembly building, a small glassed-in office located at second floor level. The hook of the crane carefully raised the spaceship from its supports, carried it across the assembly hall, and cautiously lowered it onto the attachment frame of the rocket's last stage. Within minutes, the fasteners were tightened and the connectors joined. The crane slowly shifted the last stage of the rocket and the spaceship into a horizontal position. Korolev popped up from somewhere under the rocket. Seeing Glushko standing to the side, he hurried over. "I look at this giant and my heart fills with pride." "I think the main point lies in something else." "In what?" "The fact that the people, that mankind, believed in the necessity and importance of exploring outer space. Now this process can never be halted." "You're right," Korolev assented. "If one is to reflect in philosophical terms, dialectically, then exploration of space is just as endless as the universe itself." Interrupting his train of thought, Korolev said softly, more to himself, I've never been so anxious. Everything has been checked and rechecked, and yet... I don't think that at this moment there is anyone who is completely calm. There is! Korolev joyfully exclaimed. There is! Yuri Gagarin! What a wonderful chap! Today I had a heart-to-heart talk with him about everything, even the dangers. And you know how our talk wound up? Tell me. He says to me, Don't worry, Sergei Pavlovich. Everything will be all right. Glushko laughed. A fine young man, truly courageous. Glushko's deputy in charge of flight tests approached him. An engineer's responsibilities cover everything, from checking the engines after they have been delivered to the site from the factory to their overall inspection on the launching pad on the day of the flight. Any comments? None. Don't be in a hurry, Glushko advised. Our engines don't have backups. Utmost reliability is the watchword. The two designers watched the spaceship installment operation in a silence which Glushko finally broke. Sometimes I can't believe it, Sergei. Is it really going to happen tomorrow? Yes, Valentin, tomorrow. Your miracle engines will lift this spaceship, carry it 300 kilometers closer to the stars. Suddenly changing the subject, he asked, Valentin, you haven't yet been inside the ship. Go. I've sat in the chair more than once. It's a wonderful feeling. The engine designer swiftly walked down to the ship, climbed up the metal ladder, and found himself near the entrance hatch to the Vostok. Easily, youthfully, he lowered himself into the seat, pressed the button, and a soft light flooded the interior of the craft. Examining the craft, Glushko involuntarily thought about all the designers of the various systems whom he knew well throughout the years of his joint work. That comma doesn't belong there. Yes, everything has been thought out, Glushko said to himself. And how many arguments took place about the shape of the crew module and whether manual control was needed in addition to remote control from the mission control center? He also thought of the last session of the State Commission. The flight program was being approved. Its essence was as follows. One orbit around the Earth, lasting 1 hour and 30 minutes, with a landing in a preset location. The aim of the flight was to test the possibility of a man going into outer space aboard a specially equipped craft, to test the equipment of the craft in flight, to test communications with the Earth, and to test the reliability of the means for landing safely both the craft and the cosmonaut. That same day, April 8, 1961, it was decided that Yuri Gagarin would fly. Someone's head unexpectedly showed in the hatch. Valentin Glushko recognized Yuri Gagarin right away. Need any advice from me? The cosmonaut chuckled. No, you are probably not aware, Yuri, Glushko began in his most official manner, that by decision of the State Commission, I have been appointed commander of the Vostok. A glint appeared in the gray, mischievous eyes of the pilot. I'll agree to go on the second flight. The only snag is I'm not sure that the doctors will allow you to fly. Vladimir Ivanovich Yazdovsky just barely passed me. After laughing loudly, he added in a whisper, and in relation to the health of an average person, the doctors evaluated my health at 200%. Yes, that's tough competition. I guess I'll have to yield my place. Gagarin helped the scientist out of the cabin. Climbing down, they found Korolev waiting for them. I sent Gagarin after you, the chief grinned. Half an hour went by, and you were still sitting there. I figured you forgot where you were, and began to solve some technical problem out of habit, seeing it was so nice and peaceful and no one to bother you. Well, what do you think? Glushko was silent for a while, and then, unhurriedly, as though weighing every word in order to give as accurate an evaluation as possible to all he had seen in the ship, replied, I didn't expect anything else. I'm prepared to fly it myself, if you'll trust me. We'll build a roomier ship and we'll both go, Korolev returned in kind. The work in the assembly shop proceeded apace. Powerful cranes hoisted the launch vehicle and the attached spacecraft, and, carrying the complex just below the ceiling of the huge building, gingerly lowered it onto the special railway dolly. Thus the day passed imperceptibly. Twilight descended over the settlement. The first star twinkled into life on the distant, darkened horizon. Korolev, Glushko, and Gagarin walked together, enjoying the coolness. Korolev initiated the conversation. "Well, Yuri, about the flight?" "I'm ready." "I know. We have a great deal of faith in you, Yura." Korolev embraced Gagarin round the shoulders. "We considered a long time before we made you commander of the ship. You're fortunate to be the first of the 3.5 billion people in the world to escape from the prison of the Earth's gravity, to blaze the way for others, to see the Earth from a height, the living Earth. I'll tell you a little story. You know, Yura, Valentin Petrovich and I are old friends, even if we often argue. On the eve of my 50th birthday, he gave me a present which stands prominently in my study at home. He gave me a globe, but it's not the globe so much as the inscription. I know the words by heart. 'I am giving you this sphere, Sergei, in the profound hope that you and I will see the living Earth with our own eyes, this small.'" All three fell silent, each one engrossed in his own thoughts, and when the pavement led them to the small wooden house in which the cosmonaut lived in the pre-launch days, Yuri Gagarin, as though answering his mentors, said in a low voice almost to himself, "Yes, I am lucky. In all times it has been the greatest happiness for man to participate in new discoveries." "Well said," Glushko remarked, glancing at the stocky figure of the pilot. "And have you considered, Yuri, what you're going to say before the launching, to us, Soviet people, people of the whole planet?" Korolev inquired. "I don't know. I haven't thought about it." "That's what you should talk about. The great happiness of taking part in new discoveries," Glushko advised. Yes, Yura. You can't shorten Yuri very much, but the Russians managed to have a nickname for it anyway. On April 10, 1961, at 4 p.m., a meeting of the State Commission was held. The results of the rocket and spacecraft trials were under discussion, and the preparedness of the Cosmodrome services for the launching of the first manned spaceship. "Comrades, permit me to declare this meeting of the State Commission open," Rudnev began. "Korolev has the floor to report on the state of the launch vehicle and spaceship Vostok." The chief designer rose from behind the table, even more slowly than usual, it seemed. The whole burden of the technical management of the experiment lay on his shoulders. In appearance, he was calm, and only his brown eyes, perhaps, gleamed a little more brightly. "The launch vehicle and spaceship Vostok," he said clearly in a low-keyed voice, "have undergone the full series of tests, both in the factory and at the Cosmodrome. There have been no faults in the functioning of any of the systems of either the launch vehicle or the spaceship." Korolev paused, inhaled deeply, and in the tense silence, and even with more firmness, said even with more firmness than usually, "I request the State Commission's permission to bring the launch vehicle and ship to the launching site in order to continue preparations for the blastoff, which is to take place on April 12 at 9 hours 7 minutes Moscow time." Permission was granted. Less than 48 hours remained until the launching. As never before, Korolev followed his own rule formulated many years earlier. "If you do something quickly but badly, everyone will soon forget that you did it quickly, but it will remember for a long time that you did it badly. But if you do it slowly but do it well, everyone will forget that you did it slowly, but will remember for a long time that you did it well." At 5 in the morning of April 11, the rocket was brought to the launching site. One could wish that Dolezal, the chief designer of nuclear power reactors, had remembered the same thing, because the RBMK-1000 was done quickly but badly, if you ask me. At 1 p.m. April 11 at the launching site, Yuri Gagarin was officially presented to the service personnel of the Cosmodrome. "By decision of the State Commission," General Kamanin addressed the gathering, "Yuri Gagarin has been appointed commander of the spaceship Vostok." Applause broke out. The cosmonaut stepped forward and saluted. Somehow, Gagarin at once captured everyone's hearts. Then, the representatives of different departments spoke about the rocket and ship being ready, and each speech ended with good wishes for a successful launching, a successful flight. You must reply, Korolev whispered to Gagarin. You must. Thank you for your warm greetings, the cosmonaut began with embarrassment. For the flowers, for your good wishes. Then, in military style, firmly, I will do everything to carry out the responsible mission I have been assigned, until we meet back on Earth. In the meantime, all the systems of the rocket and craft were checked over and over again. After the meeting, Sergei Korolev and Yuri Gagarin ascended to the ship and stayed there over an hour. The academician gave his pupil parting advice. When he came down, Korolev felt ill. Cardiac pills did not help. Without saying a word to Voskresensky about his indisposition, Korolev told him, "Phone me in a couple of hours. I might sleep through otherwise." He departed for the small wooden house, surrounded by young poplars and a carpet of flowers, where he was living, some 15 minutes by car from the launching pad. Two other identical houses stood nearby. The closest was the cosmonaut's cottage. In it, Yuri Gagarin would spend that night. Sergei Korolev went through the small study. The moon illuminated the desk, the lamp with a green shade standing on it, the telephone. Before reaching the dining room, however, the scientist turned back, entered the study, and switched on the light. He went to the bookshelf. He liked to read before going to sleep, but a telephone call distracted him from books. "Yes, Korolev speaking," he replied in a tired voice. "Yes, yes, I did order a call." Pulling out the chair energetically, he began speaking. "Did I wake you, Nina?" "No." "Good." At the conclusion of their conversation, he asked his wife, "Wish us good luck." After hanging up, Korolev sat quietly for a few minutes. He was very fatigued by the last few days, and today his heart had been acting up. At the wrong time, he thought, I must get some sleep. Taking a small glass vial, which he always carried on him, out of his side pocket, he removed a pill and placed it under his tongue. He lay down on the couch in the study, unbuttoned his woolen shirt. He closed his eyes, but sleep would not come. Thoughts about the morrow gave him no peace. Had everything been done? Had it? His brain whirled. What if they were right? He thought of Koptilov and his insistence that mankind was not yet ready to enter outer space. Yes, it's ready, Korolev said almost aloud, decisively, and everything that is within human powers has been done. The pain in his heart eased. Outside the window, the white moon loomed in the pre-dawn darkness. The academician got up, opened the window. The morning coolness was pleasant on his face. He saw that in the neighboring houses, lights were on. Feeling for the telephone, Korolev lifted the receiver and dialed Rudnev's number.
You're not asleep, Konstantin Nikolaevich.
I didn't think so. How can one sleep? 5 minutes later, the doors of the two cottages standing next to each other opened simultaneously. Korolev and Rudnev met by the flower bed. They stopped, not saying a word. Then, still in silence, both glanced at the cosmonaut's cottage.
They're not asleep either, Rudnev muttered.
They can't be. Nikolai Kamanin is a restless soul, Korolev replied. Excuse me, I'll just be a moment. He quietly walked over to the cosmonaut's house. On tiptoe, he approached the room in which Gagarin and Titov were sleeping. Pushing the door ajar, he peered in. Peacefully as on any ordinary night, the cosmonauts slept. He came back from the house very pleased and got into the car where Rudnev was waiting for him. To the launching site, he told the driver. 6 hours remained until Yuri Gagarin's flight. This is one of those things which is sort of like some of the old histories. It's written halfway in the style of a story. I should check the moon phase for April 11th, 1962, because I'm not really sure whether you could see the full moon or not. Now, of course, I have to figure out what date format Foon
accepts to calculate the thing. Anyway, let's go on. Yevgeny Karpov and Nikolai Kamanin, the men in charge of the Cosmonauts Corps, could not close their eyes that night. In the neighboring room, Gagarin and Titov slept soundly. The shaded light fell on a round table, an open volume of Pushkin's poetry, newspapers, flowers. Karpov looked at his watch. It was almost 5:30 a.m. "Is it time?" "Yes," General Kamanin answered. Karpov went over to Gagarin's bed. "Time to get up." Gagarin was up so quickly, he might not have been asleep. "How did you sleep?" "As you taught us," the pilot laughed. Herman Titov got up just as quickly. Poor Titov, aside from being known to history as Cosmonaut Number 2, also Western publications always get his name wrong, because, of course, in Russian, in Cyrillic, there's no distinction between G and H. They use the same letter for both, and so his name is often transliterated as German or something dumb like that. Let's see. The space wardrobe. The spacesuits hung on specially designed stands, awaiting their owners. With the help of medical assistants, Yuri Gagarin and Herman Titov checked the sensors attached to their bodies and intended for transmitting information on physical condition to Earth. Engineer Yevgeny Alexandrov and spacesuit designer Vadim Semyonov watched to see that everything was in order. The dressing procedure was unhurried. Everything was done carefully. First, the woolen underwear was put on, then the spacesuit. Over that, orange coveralls. Naturally, gloves and boots. Last, the space helmet. The headgear had a transparent visor, which could be opened and shut, either manually or automatically. On the front of the white helmet were lettered the initials for USSR, which is to say it looks like Latin CCCP, but it's actually Cyrillic SSSR. Doctor of Medical Sciences, Vasily Parin, and Professor Vladimir Yazdovsky observed the proceedings. "I can hardly believe it's going to happen today," Parin said. "I've been so exhausted by these past few days that I have only one desire. Hurry it up!" "You know, Yazdovsky, many people, even our colleagues, believe that the day will come in about a decade." "Is that so?" "Careful! Don't knock off that sensor!" Parin shouted to Gagarin's dressers. "On the eve of my departure for the Cosmodrome, I met Ivan Rufinov. You know him. We were talking, and he suddenly said, 'Do you think that in some 10 years men will be able to fly in outer space?'" "So what did you say?" Gagarin asked, overhearing the conversation. "You lied to him, of course," Titov intervened. "Not at all. I said very significantly that everything might happen sooner." "In 9 years, Gagarin laughed. Sergei Korolev dropped in for a moment. Looking at the smiling cosmonauts, he himself smiled. "Everything in order? With us, too." Against the background of the clear morning sky, the rocket looked huge. The final checkup of all ship's systems was underway. The lift was brought up. The first to ascend to the top of the rocket was the leading designer, Alexei Ivanov. Half an hour later, not able to bear being parted from the ship, engineer-designer Konstantin Feoktistov went up in the lift. At a height of 30 meters, the wind whipped strongly at the platform. Huddling from the cold, he joked, "In that cabin of yours, it's as warm as at home. Out here, it's windy." "Come in, warm up," Alexei Ivanov invited him. "The time will come," Feoktistov seriously replied, "when three will be able to travel together. Eventually more." Feoktistov had a right to say so. He had taken a direct part in the development and construction of the Vostok, and so his colleague was in no way surprised by his words. The designer had for some time been thinking of spacecraft in the near future, which would stay up in space, not for an hour or two, but for many days on end. As a matter of fact, the Vostok was modified to become the Voskhod, or Voskhod, which carried three people, and on its first flight, Feoktistov was one of them, and it's said that he wouldn't normally have passed the medical for it, but that the cosmonauts insisted that the designer go up with them, although whether this was because they admired his work or because they wanted him up there in case everything went bad, you know. The thought being, you know, if he thinks this is safe, we're not sure this is safe, but if he thinks it's safe, he can write it. Time passed imperceptibly. From the hatch, Alexei Ivanov's voice sounded. I've checked everything myself most thoroughly. Any comments? None. Fine. Just in case, I'll check once more. The engineer climbed out, giving way to Konstantin Feoktistov. That I'll check once more could have offended someone else, but the engineer was too well acquainted with his colleague, with his passion for controlling everything. The engineer designer slowly clicked over all the switches on the control panel, turned on the communication system, and spoke into the microphone. This is Vostok. How do you read me? When the operator on duty replied, he asked for the exact time. It was 7:30. Feoktistov climbed out and said to the waiting Alexei Ivanov, Right. Everything's in order. The cosmonaut will be here soon. Are you remaining? Yes. Coming out of the lift, Feoktistov saw Korolev, Keldysh, and Glushko standing near the communications point. Any comments? Korolev greeted his associate. None. Unable to restrain himself, Feoktistov added, It wouldn't be a bad idea for us engineers to go up in space. The scientists exchanged glances. Korolev looked sharply at the young designer, frowned, and muttered something in reply. He had noticed that similar suggestions were heard more and more often from specialists. He discerned in them an attempt to prepare him, Korolev, for serious discussions on engineers going up into space. In itself, the idea was attractive and seemed sound to the academician. But glancing at the spare figure of the engineer, at his pale face and prematurely graying temples, he thought doubtfully, will he be able to stand the stress of launching and descent? Besides, he needed him so much on Earth. On the other hand, Korolev understood his pupil very well. After all, when he had built gliders and planes, he had liked to test them himself. When we create a multi-seater craft and develop a soft landing system, then we'll go up together for 3 days. Agreed? No objections? Feoktistov did not even smile, but replied in such a way as though the question of his flight had long been decided, and it was only a matter of settling the exact date. It is essential for me to fly. Essential. He turned away and left. The scientists went back to their conversation. In full space garb, Yuri Gagarin stood at the foot of the rocket. He reported to the chairman of the State Commission on his readiness. Then he ascended to the platform in front of the lift and, raising his hand, asked for attention. Dear friends, close and unknown, fellow countrymen, people of all countries and continents, Gagarin began his address to the peoples of the world. In a few minutes, this powerful spaceship will take me to the far-off expanses of the universe. What can I say to you in these final minutes before the start? For a second, the cosmonaut reflected. Right now, all my life seems to me one wonderful instant. Everything that I have experienced, everything that I have done hitherto, was experienced and done for the sake of this moment. Am I happy setting off on this space flight? The audience waited with bated breath for the answer. He said honestly, without pretense, Of course I am happy. In all times and epochs, the greatest happiness for man has been to take part in new discoveries. He continued firmly, I wish to dedicate this first space flight to the people of a communist society, the society which our Soviet people are already entering, and which I am convinced all the people on Earth will enter. He glanced at his watch, smiled broadly. I say to you, dear friends, goodbye, as people always say to each other when setting off on a distant journey, I would like to embrace you all, friends and strangers, distant and close. See you soon. In answer, applause and exclamations from the assembled gathering. Happy journey, until we meet again. Exiting from the lift, Yuri Gagarin began to climb the metal ladder to the platform which led to the cabin of the spaceship. The day before, he and Korolev had been there together. They had stood for a long time in silence, each thinking his own thoughts. The boundless steps were deserted. Only the pylons of the high-voltage lines marched away in different directions like giants. Somewhere on the horizon, the steppe merged with the beautifully white sky. And what lay beyond it? White clouds slowly drifted across the sky. From their vantage point, even this barren steppe seemed marvelously beautiful. Lit by the sun, it looked like a gigantic mosaic, laid out in strange-shaped plates of gray, brown, yellow, violet, fiery crimson. Korolev broke the silence. Probably from a height, our Earth looks very lovely. And turning to Gagarin, gazed into his eyes and smiled. Lucky man to be the first to see it from such a height. The smile vanished, and that unusual brilliance appeared in his eyes, which momentarily transformed their expressions. Gagarin saw the great excitement which could not be concealed, and which gripped this strong and determined man. The tone of conversation altered instantly. Both the start and the flight will not be easy. You, Yura, will experience stress and weightlessness, and possibly something unknown to us. All this you are aware of. We have talked enough about it, and nevertheless I want to remind you once again that there is an element of risk involved in tomorrow's flight. Nothing new to you in that either. The scientist put his hands on Gagarin's shoulders, and in an unusual manner, employing the familiar form of address, said in a warm and fatherly fashion, "Anything can happen, Yura, but remember one thing. All the powers of our minds will immediately be given to you." Sergei Korolev fell silent, then unexpectedly smiled broadly and said confidently, "Everything will be all right. I am absolutely positive of success." "And so am I. I will do everything to carry out the responsible mission I have been assigned." Gagarin repeated the words he had said when he was appointed commander of the Vostok. A little bit more, and Gagarin found himself on the platform where Alexei Ivanov and Yevgeny Alexandrov were waiting to help him into the cabin. They embraced. Gagarin lowered himself down the hatch and into the seat in which he would accomplish the world's first space flight. At that moment, Korolev was descending along a narrow stone staircase to the underground shelter which housed the launch control post. He stepped slowly, thinking. Slightly behind him followed Rudnev, chairman of the State Commission, and other members of the Commission. Halting for a second, Korolev turned to the chairman. "Well said by Gagarin, eh?" "Yes. And was his address to the people taped?" the chairman asked in turn. "Yes, it was," someone replied from the back. "Gagarin's address to the peoples of the world must be sent to Moscow. It should be broadcast over the radio immediately after the TASS announcement." Because, of course, it didn't go out live. The Soviets never released anything until it actually happened. A small rectangular room. Along one of the walls stands equipment hidden in metal boxes. A countless number of flashing lights. Red, yellow, blue, green. A screen. A small control panel. Among other buttons is one the size of a copper coin that will launch the rocket on its way. The operator on duty stands nearby. To the right of the entrance is a periscope, whose eye is outside on the surface. It projects on its screen, like a colored postcard, the whole length of the rocket from top to bottom. The members of the State Commission go into the next room. Only Academician Korolev remains in the control room, by the periscope, and the operators by their posts. A 90-minute state of readiness is declared. Korolev pushed a button on the communications panel. A blue light flashed on and twinkled like a star. The microphone buzzed slightly. Then a voice was heard. "Coordination Computing Center, duty officer speaking." "This is Zarya. Give me the number one." Instantly, the clear, precise voice of the head of the CCC came on. "Speaking." The Coordination Computing Center is located thousands of kilometers away from the Cosmodrome. However, modern communications media make it possible for it to hear everything that is happening at the launch site and that will happen during the flight. Special ground communication stations located in different parts of the country make this possible. Taken altogether, this is called Radio Command and Computer Complex. All the preparations in the CCC for the Vostok launching were completed. The experts on the ship's systems, designers, engineers, medical specialists, biologists, mathematicians, physicists, were all present, waiting intently. A big job lay ahead of them, which demanded exceptional accuracy in a situation which called for incredibly swiftly reached decisions. Although quite a few dress rehearsals had been held, today, when a man would fly into space for the first time, everyone was anxious. The CCC personnel had to analyze the information relayed from the spacecraft, in particular, the telemetric measurements, compare them with the preliminary calculations and indices, and determine how the onboard equipment was functioning. But the first thing that would be required of them was to precisely establish the parameters of the orbit which Vostok would enter. All this had to be known on Earth and in space. When the cosmonaut receives the information relayed by the CCC, he will check the time with mission control, make corrections in the navigation system, and determine the ship's location over the Earth. In keeping with the new or modified data on the parameters of the orbit, experts will work out the necessary instructions to mission control and determine the final time and place of descent. In order to process, in a matter of minutes, all the information coming from the Vostok, and it is counted in millions of signals, the most modern electronic computers are at the disposal of the CCC experts. Information on the functioning of onboard equipment, the cosmonaut's condition, data on the radiation situation, which is changeable and directly dependent on solar activity, would be transmitted at once to the State Commission. The government of the USSR had invested it with the power to independently resolve all questions connected with the flight, including the right to interrupt it if circumstances warranted this. I beg you to relay all information, even preliminary, to me at once, Korolev requested. He knew that he would be informed of everything, but nevertheless, he reminded them. He believed it better to remind 10 times than to forget once. And particularly as regards all calculations on the landing of the Vostok, time is of the essence. I beg you. A steely note entered his voice. He was giving a command. Everything will be done strictly according to the timetable, the CCC chief assured the academician. Thank you. Good luck. Korolev switched off and scanned the room for his deputy, Leonid Voskresensky. How are you feeling, Leonid? Korolev asked, examining his colleague attentively. Fine. Your heart isn't bothering you? Can one's heart be calm at a time like this? And seriously, the scientist demanded sternly, and without waiting for a reply, said, I still suggest you go into hospital for treatment. That's an order. Do you understand? I hope not this very minute. Not this one, Korolev smiled. In the meantime, report. Without interrupting, the academician listened to his deputy's report on the progress of tests of all the launch vehicle's systems. Voskresensky spoke confidently, spoke concisely and with assurance. Good. Thank you. Korolev got up and, squeezing the engineer's hard hand, held him back for a second. With a sly and confidential smile, he said, I happen to have some cardiac pills in my pocket. I can share them. Each taking a pill, they went off to their places. Korolev knew how the final preparations were going from the orders which were transmitted over the radio. Sometimes he intervened in the flow himself, asking for more precise details of the run-through of all systems on the rocket and craft, hurrying somebody along, demanding more thoroughness from someone else, promising to give it to somebody. He sat in a chair and strolled about in turn. Even this courageous man could not help but be anxious. He kept thinking, has everything been done to ensure success? Everything? Kamanin and Popovich were engaged in a pre-launch exchange with the cosmonaut. The chief walked over to the microphone. In as calm a voice as he could master, he said, This is Zarya. How do you read? I read you well. Then, tersely, military style, communications test run completed. The initial position of the switches on the control panel is as per instructions. The pressure in the cabin is 1.0, humidity 65%, temperature 19 degrees, pressure in the compartment 1.2, pressure in the orientation systems, normal. The cosmonaut paused, then concluded cheerfully, Feeling fine, ready to go. In order to make the wait before the start less tedious for the cosmonaut, it had been decided to transmit music aboard the ship. Korolev, Well, have they piped the music aboard yet? Gagarin, Not yet. Russians, after all, hither and yon, what can you expect? Gagarin, now it's on. A love song. Korolev, a love song? I'd say it's just about right. Minutes were left until the last one, the decisive one. Sergei Korolev took the microphone and began calling up people to check again and again that all services were ready for the rocket launching. Then he readdressed Gagarin. Korolev, Yuri, I just want to remind you. Advice. So don't worry. Gagarin, Roger, I've got you. I'm completely relaxed. Korolev, fine. 6 more minutes of this and that, so to say. When the chief was conclusively certain that everything was normal, he nodded to his deputy, who was standing by the periscope. The latter switched on the chronometer, and the room filled with an even tick-tock, tick-tock. Korolev, 1 minute countdown, how do you read? Gagarin, Roger, 1 minute countdown. Have taken up departure position. The pointer raced around the black face, approaching 9. Voznesensky, the deputy, issued the final commands. Key into go position. Air purging. Idle run. Ignition. Then, like a pistol shot, liftoff! A distant roar penetrated the underground bunker, the sound of the rocket engines. Through the periscope could be seen how, shooting off flames, the rocket shuddered and started slowly, as though unwillingly, to part from the launching pad. Gagarin. Poyekhali! Footnote there says, off we go. Everything going normally, feeling fine, on top, everything normal. Korolev, we all wish you a good flight, everything normal. Turning to everybody, Korolev exclaimed, a fine fellow, a real Russian hero. Gagarin, goodbye, until we meet again. Sergei Korolev and the cosmonaut continued a technical conversation. Suddenly Gagarin did not reply. Korolev, Kidder, how are you? Only a buzzing filled the room. The academician's voice grew harsh. Kidder, reply. Nothing but the indifferent buzzing in answer. Kidder, reply. Zarya calling. Korolev willed him to speak. Into another microphone he called, Contact, fast. What was happening? Had Gagarin fainted from the stress? Had the pressure failed? Had the pressurization failed? But the telemetric center reported that the flight was normal and that the pressure inside the cabin was normal. Suddenly, breaking the oppressive tension, a calm voice came through. Gagarin, the fairing has been discarded. I am seeing the earth. The loads are increasing. Feeling fine. Tops. The academician could not contain himself. He almost shouted. Good for you. Fine. Everything going well. Gagarin, the spaceship is separating. Overwhelmed, the operator shouted at the top of his voice. Spaceship with men on board is in orbit. Gagarin, it's so beautiful. A little while later, the whole world heard Moscow radio announcer Yuri Levitan read the TASS statement. On April 12, 1961, in the Soviet Union, the Vostok, the world's first manned spacecraft, has been launched into orbit around the Earth. The launching of the multi-stage space rocket proceeded successfully. And after the Earth satellite velocity had been attained, and the spaceship separated from the last stage of the rocket vehicle, of the launch vehicle, the craft began its free flight in orbit around the Earth. Yuri Gagarin's... That's the TASS announcement there. Yuri Gagarin's flight continued normally. The Vostok, flying around the Earth, went out of direct radio contact. Korolev left the control room and ran into Konstantin Feoktistov. He hugged him around the shoulders in unrestrained joy. Congratulations! What a day! In a manner quite foreign to Korolev, he added, You haven't had it easy. I know I've given you hell. Forgive me. Don't hold it against me. This was so unexpected that Feoktistov did not know what to say. Anyway, there's more here, but we've come to the end of the time allotted. Just remind you that if you enjoy and want to support these broadcasts, you can join my Patreon campaign, patreon.com/Publius_reads, or you can send me PayPal, paypal.me/PubliusLector, and I look forward to receiving your cards and letters at Post Office Box 1035.